Good evening, everybody. Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, and it's The Hidden Work. This is a continuation of Chapter 7, and we took a stab at it last week, and it's just too big and too much to try to finish it in 1 week. So this will be the second part of it. I think we'll be able to finish tonight, and then next week we'll continue on with Chapter 8. When you get a chance, if you haven't, go on and take a look at the not only the summary that's been done by Lupe and Harry, but also a really wonderful posting by Silverdale George, who really gave us a good background of the way that the Gurdjieffian work views it and is a beginning. A stepping stone for us here to get going. Why don't you reorient us on this? Before we get into the chapter, what I want to do is I want to bring up a comment that you made last week after the class was over.
Right.
And it's a very important point. And just go ahead and make your point, and then I'll comment on it, okay? And what did you say after the end of the class last week, and then you had something to say?
I was sitting in the back of the room listening to the discussion on the hidden work. And David talked about different professions that we might be into, and he mentioned geology, and that's a particular specialty of mine, so my ears perked up. And in relationship to what he was talking about, I was thinking of geology classes and actually most of the college classes at least in the undergraduate world, is vocabulary. It's about 70% vocabulary. And here we are, we're creating a vocabulary so we can all talk about these concepts together. So for a geologist, if I said strike slip fault, a geologist would understand that. We would have gone out and measured it. We'd have had some sort of understanding of it. We'd all be on the same page with it. So here we are learning in the hidden work of vocabulary in much the same way, where we can all talk together in the same understanding. And when we get into absolute prayer, then we're actually learning a vocabulary where we can perform obligations and these rites that we can use, and we have a heavy understanding of this. So this is a vocabulary that we're working on here, a large component of how we're working right now is through this understanding of what EJ is presenting here in the hidden work.
Yeah, and so just to give a little bit of context, we're investigating areas that are not commonly investigated in normal life, just in everyday life. We don't stop to consider that. We may have blips of feelings about it. We may have sensations, like a blip of a sensation. But what we're doing is we're dissecting that. We're taking it apart. We're saying, okay, now let's focus on that sensation. And when we can focus on it and we can, in a sense, make it our own, and we give a word to it, like let's say we use a word like the sensing mechanism, how I would sense. That starts to make some sense to us. The more we speak about it together, the better our dialogue is in it. And then we actually have a tool. I talk about having a toolkit. We have a toolkit that we can take out into the world and then develop it out even further. So that's what we're partly trying to do here. My goal, I'm very interested in the idea of a pragmatic approach to understanding some of this stuff. How can you do it? We have a beginning of understanding of what it is, but we also want to know, how can I do it in 20 minutes, you know, or after an hour and a half or tomorrow? Because we're imbued at the moment. We come into the class and we take the time, as some people indicated a few classes ago, they have a bit of a ritual that they use when they come. They stop doing what they're doing. And I often talk about, let's take a moment and get rid of the dust from the road of the world. And let's take it, our time, this hour, together, and cleanse our space and cleanse ourselves so we can stand in the area we're going to call the essential self. And we identify being in that waking state, being in the essential self, by what Silverdale has referred to and others have referred to as a vibratory sensation that is so unique that we can say, yeah, there it is. And then there it is again. And we can surprise ourselves getting into what we're going to call then that vibratory sensation. And then part of the mechanism is, how can we find our way back to it every once in a while? We will lose it. We'll lose it, and we'll go back into what we call the mechanicality of our state, of our sleeping state. And there's sleeping state, waking state, so on and so forth. Part of what we're going to address tonight is that we're not going to be working with the idea of judgment or guilt on these things, but we're going to get real close to it. So we're going to have to be careful as we proceed. So thank you for that. So jargon, specialty language, these are the things that we're going to be addressing in part. Okay? So to get us started, why don't you get us started, MA, by reading the header of chapter 7. So chapter 7, part 2, and we're going to just reorient a little bit. Where are we in all of this, okay?
Okay, so it looks like I'm starting on page somewhere around page 55, chapter 7, Pity for the Absolute. An evolved human being is hungry to fulfill his obligation toward the Absolute. If we feel genuine pity for the Absolute, we may have the beginning of real conscience. Real conscience is the beginning of real work.
This is, and for all of us, this should be quite disturbing, because it's kind of laid out right there. It's this idea of real conscience. If I can get to this place called real conscience, then I'm in this place called the beginning of real work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't it behoove us to begin to understand what might that mean, real conscience? And then let's backtrack. If we feel a genuine pity for the Absolute, and it's an interesting thing. You read that, and I think everybody here, and there's several people here tonight, we say that word. We say a genuine pity for the suffering of the Absolute. Just hold that just for a second. Just hold that. A pity for the suffering of the Absolute. And there's a sensation of that. We have a sensation, right? Doesn't it kind of seem true? I mean, can you feel it just a little bit? Just a little bit of
a twang.
a twang or a touch. It's like I can feel like a touch of what that might mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to honor that. I'm going to honor that. But in a certain way, another way, we don't really know what that means. It's too big. Suffering, the pity for the suffering of the Absolute, that's like the big boys choir, you know? I mean, that's like all the way to the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we're not quite there yet. So what can we do is the question. Go ahead, Ken.
Genuinely pity is equal
So Simon is reminding us online that genuine pity equals real conscience. So it's like it's laid out there, but as MA was telling us earlier about jargon, we don't really know what these words mean. We have a sense of what they mean. But what I want to do is we are creating this new ground here, okay? We are. EJ has written this book. This book, in my opinion, is an outline that hasn't been written. This is a unique material. And it does stand on the shoulders of the Gurdjieffian work and other Sufic work that's out there. But nevertheless, and other works too. This is a dialogue, a dialectic of humanity. Mm-hmm. It's putting it into words as he has is unique, but it follows from a whole dialectic that's been going on since the beginning of time. But can we define for ourselves, not for like the objective world forever? We're not addressing philosophers. We're not philosophers. We're spelunkers. We're mountain climbers and spelunkers, okay? We're going to get our axes out and our boots on. And we're going to travel our own path. So we want to come away from some of this with the beginning of a sensation of what might it actually be to be in what's called real conscience. And something about the suffering of the absolute, all right? So let's see if we can get this. So we worked on a lot of bringing those concepts out in the first part. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure what page we ended on. But I read this and I reread it and then I take new notes so mm-hmm. everything changes.
We didn't really get too far in reading the chapter.
No, we didn't. Mm-hmm. And
we talked a lot about the chapter itself, but page 60.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's about where I'm at. Good. Page 60, second paragraph.
Okay.
Good. So part of where we are, just to reorient, is this idea of obligation comes to play here, this sense of wanting to give back. Because when we become blessed, and we become blessed with this, being in this space, it's truly angelic. We are blessed to be here, mm-hmm. in whatever way you want to look at that. But we're invigorated, we're made whole again when we're in these spaces like that. And then we have a sense of wanting to give back. And we say, okay, I'm going to give back, okay? And we say, okay, how do I give back? Well, maybe I can do something to alleviate the suffering of the absolute. And we go, yeah, I want to do that. I want to help alleviate the suffering of the absolute. So there's a sense of obligation. Obligation is a very big word. It's big in all disciplines, like in the philosophic disciplines. It's got a very specific thing. There's a difference between obligation and duty. Duty is more externally based. Duty is, I got to do this. I got to do it because it's my kid. Or I got to do it because it's my job. But obligation springs from like something internal where we're compelled to move. We're compelled by what I call the necessity of one's own nature. The necessity of our nature compels us to do that. Now, at this level of our work, we're not able to take on very much obligation. Individuals like EJ and Lee Lozowick, and a number of other people that you don't know, those are names that you know, but a number of other people, had a moment, I surmise, where they were able to say yes to taking on an obligation. At that point, their life was changed. And we're going to come back to a phrase called, because you are able, therefore you must. Becky? And Becky is saying, is genuine pity feeling sorry for something, or is it seen in a different way? And we clearly are going to distinguish between, let's just say, a pity of life. Pity of life is an ego thing. I pity these poor bastards, you know. Look at them. You know, they should be more like me. That's, you know, that's like an ego pity. It's a, that's not what we're talking about. You are moved when you see the reality of it. You're moved to a particular type of conscience. When you see what's going on, you're moved by that. Now, Becky is saying not only seeing, but also being more honest with yourself. And that's the heart of where I want to go with this chapter. Because now, suffering is an interesting thing, because we're going to clearly distinguish between the suffering because, you know, your job is too busy, you're not making enough money, you know, really busy today, and you had a blowout in your car. There's no question that's pain, right? That's painful. You know, you don't have enough money sometimes.
Yeah.
Does that ever cause you a little teeny bit?
It's raining. It's foggy.
The world.
Yes, I mean all these.
This person has fog.
It's fog.
So it's raining and you have to drive somewhere and you're afraid. And that's painful. There's no question about it. And there's the pain that you have because you're not achieving your life goals, or you broke up with your boyfriend, you broke up with your girlfriend, your kid doesn't like you anymore, you broke your guitar string just at the wrong moment. Yeah, that's painful, right? All that's painful stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. We're talking about a different kind of suffering, and that's what we want to begin to get to. So what is this suffering that the Absolute, I mean, come on, that's God, right? Isn't it the same of God? God's like perfect, and I thought God was supposed to help me, right? God was going to, I mean, I prayed that I wanted like a new car this year. And
you said all your prayers?
I did, and I didn't get the new car. I don't know what happened. So Jim H. is telling us that I'm on the wrong track here, that suffering has something to do with, he's calling it soul ache. What is it that the soul could possibly ache for? Let me do another thing here. Of course, maybe we can't see the full concept of what's called the suffering of the Absolute, but don't we have that a little bit in ourselves too? Aren't we a piece of that Absolute? Don't we have a little mirror that is called the Absolute inside us? And when we truly get to the depths of the essential self, that's what's ringing in us. So how can the Absolute, how can we, what is that ache? What is the ache? Okay, so what could it mean that the soul aches. What is it in that context? So we got a few things bubbling around here. Obligation, mm-hmm. right? This compelled to take on obligation, this suffering, pity. Pity in a different way that Becky's telling us, a bigger pity than just pitying some, you know, homeless guy. Right?
Mm-hmm. Not from an ego point of view.
So, ego point of view, when you're in that point of view, it is by definition an external. And we're dealing with an internal world here. We're changing our internal world, and we're writing a new dictionary. We are writing a dictionary. Ambrose Bierce wrote a dictionary, but we're writing a different dictionary. And it's not out there yet. And for the last three books, and Simon can tell us as I keep using this term, like here's another element in our tool kit that we're wearing on our belt, adoration, attention. Now this conscience, what if that became an actual live tool for us? So once again, what's inside, okay? It's developing, in a sense, an objective sense of something inside. We all know this feeling, right? I'm not talking about an idea. I'm talking about a feeling we have, this ache. And when we get to chapter 11, and I've kind of assigned chapter 11 to chapter 11 is probably going to be Gerald in London, but he can't come to the class because it's 4 in the morning. Now listen to this. In motion bowing, my presence comes to thee. Humbly, with heart alive, my presence awakens to thee. With clear mind, my presence comes to know thee. Now, with pity for thy suffering, my presence becomes aware of thee. It's like when we get to a point where we can hold that pity for thy suffering, suddenly we're aware. What is it that we're aware of? Pity for thy suffering, then I'm aware of. Isn't that interesting?
Well, you invoke the presence of your presence into the present.
But what am I
point.
Aware of? What am I aware of? I understand I am aware, mm-hmm. but I'm aware of the pity for thy suffering. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that make sense to us?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are a number of pet people that are, I don't know if Aria's on, but the Hawk Lady, Christian, I mean, a lot of people that love, really put a lot of time into pets. I mean, serious efforts. And they can sense the suffering in a sense of, and that creates an awareness in the individual. Dog's going through something or whatever, the pet duck. But it's, they are gaining an awareness. Yes, sir. Okay, so Ad Lusum says the feeling of separation is what she thinks it is. From what to what? What is it we're... I don't get it. What are we separated from? With yearning, my presence wishes to comfort thee. That's the one that always gets me. That this we'll get into that in detail in a few, several weeks, but it's yearning. I yearn for that. And there's something about that that we want. So what is the suffering of the absolute? Okay, jumping ahead. You can taste this idea. You can listen to this, annoying something inside yourself. Most people never become aware of the higher hunger to help the absolute. We're talking about, yes, we already are there. How do I work with it then? Their hunger, you know, there's also the hunger for imaginary pleasures. Then we're drawn to a school, he goes on to say. Life provides two rivers. Two rivers. We live in two rivers, okay? We live in, do we not live in two rivers? Don't we live here in the mechanical self?
Well, we're very dual in our nature.
Oh, okay, can you say more about that?
Well, we have a mechanical life on one side, but then we have we're developing a will to understand the absolute or to know the absolute on another side.
How about our own? Like, how about our own potential? Do we not have a great potential? Do we not? Everybody in this room right now and everybody online has a totally angelic presence. And everybody, I mean, many of these people I've talked to, I know, I've met, that are online. And these are usual individuals with this great presence sitting there. And are we also not longing for that? For that to be come forth? And back to Spinoza, once again, he says, to live in accordance with one's own nature. The higher nature is what he's talking about in that particular phrase. So don't we also yearn for that to be used in a certain way, fully as we can? And then we get closer and closer, and then what happens? And then we don't. Right? So what's going on there? Right? There's this duality between the knowledge that we have that we are an essential self. It's clear and distinct. It gets more clear and distinct. And then there's like a, we're also saddened because we get pulled back. We get pulled back into mechanicality. We're going to come back to that point. That is, when you begin, jumping ahead to 61, when you begin serious work on the perfection of your inner life, the same voice will nag you day and night, even worse than before. It will only get worse if you have chosen the path of self-gratification. Only when we have paid our full debt to nature, have taken a serious one-way irreversible vow to devote our lives to work. That's the concept of obligation. If that is external, you haven't made it. It's an internal vow. And it's just like you're compelled to live in that way. For the first time, we can seriously begin the long process of waking the machine toward the eventual possible transformation for the sake of the work. Many come to school for help in the alleviation of their own pain. And that's what they think work on themselves is. That's understandable. I mean, it's understandable. That might be the spark that gets you to a school. You're so screwed up and messed up and it looks pretty good over there, I'll go over there. And you go there. And I mean, that's the motive for a lot of people. They fix whatever needs to be fixed, and then they go. But we're talking about a different thing here. We're not talking about giving up the suffering. We're not talking about alleviating your own personal pain here. We're talking about coming to a different level of suffering. We're talking about something that is referred to, and I think Silverdale will hear this too, conscious suffering. This is something that we do ourselves. So we're not here to just alleviate a personal thing, but how do you do it? How do you get out of it? One thing you can do is, well, just fix all the things that are wrong. Like, I have a bad attitude towards cats, so I'll work on that. I don't like, I have a money problem. I'll work on that. I can't concentrate and read these books. I'll work on that. That's one way to do it. That's one way to handle it. But there's another way. There's another way, and this is what I want to get into tonight, is this. We can never, and jumping ahead, we must understand that we can never escape personal suffering. We can only absorb greater suffering, but not excluding our own suffering. Our own lives are not independent from the work. Our lives are the work. Is that a crack up or what?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow. That's the mind blower of this chapter, okay? It's not the suffering that we have as individuals. We have it, and I admire and I'm saddened by it. But I'm also, there's another suffering. It's the suffering that the longing for our fulfillment, that we're not there, and that we keep getting pulled back into our mechanicality. Like, there's something that will occur to every one of us tomorrow, and we'll go into our regular sleep state, and we'll have left off the passion for focus on the higher. It will occur. Each one of us have a signature where that will occur tomorrow. For some, it'll be quiet self-pity. For others, it'll be the illusion of busyness, getting lost in the busyness. It'll always have an external element to it, them. And your language will start changing. They did this. It's their fault. See what they did to me. Language will start changing. So something will occur in the next, I'm going to be generous and say 24 hours, that will sweep us away, in a sense, from the signature that we're finding of the higher. That's the yearning I'm talking about. And the sadness is that we're locked in where we are. And what I'm trying to say is that that's the suffering that we are posing, that this mechanicality right here fails, stops, is hindered by my own mechanicality keeps stopping me from the joy of fulfillment. I love being in this space. It's just like, this is where I'm most active and alive. And I'm going to do something in the next 24 hours, and it'll be as far away from this as can be. That's sad. That's a sadness. Sad that of the condition of my own package here. And if those who have traveled from another area will come, and they'll be imbued with a certain energy. And there's a sadness that in a day or two or three or four when they get back home, it'll be a vague memory rather than a present fire. So that's a form of personal suffering that is greater than the let's say, everyday pains that we have. Does this make any sense at all, what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Am I off? Or
no,
I
think it's spot on.
Is it?
Yeah, I think
okay.
So.
I'm not, you know.
I mean, you're expressing something that will happen to us. I mean, in our present state, this is the way it will be for us. We will be working on this little part, and all of a sudden we'll be off into something else and we have no knowledge or remembrance of this, and all of a sudden we'll come back. Oh yeah, I was thinking about the Absolute and trying to have pity for the suffering of the Absolute. What was that all about again?
So the Absolute is in the same dichotomy. It's in the same, it's stuck to creation, and creation is mostly asleep. It's mostly asleep, and it's longing to do something different. So when we as individuals, so how can we incorporate a form of conscious suffering on a day-to-day basis? Are there any other, I'm rambling on here, we're okay. And so, yeah, go ahead, Tito. So Tito is asking the question, I use the phrase like a joy of fulfillment, a state that I'm in from time to time, and or this higher vibratory sensation that we talk about, being in that sense of that sensing place where it feels like, you know, this is it. And he's saying, do you have to have that in order to also feel genuine pity? I'm gonna go ahead and say yes, you must. Because what we're talking about here is the dichotomy of our lives and pity for the suffering of ourself, but in this higher sense. In the higher sense that our fulfillment is to become part of the Absolute, to fulfill our role, and that is taking over the man on the cross. And it's like, I know I can do it, I know I can do it. What happened? And now it's a month later.
Yeah.
So, watching me in that dichotomy. Now, when we're with our fellows in our work circle, we can watch each other and help each other. But it's, can we stand in that moment of separation MH and others have said, we're separated from our higher selves, and we're separated from our home of the Absolute. We're separated from that. But yes, you must have tasted it in order to have a remorse of not being there. So go ahead. So, you know, just on page 62, if this is true on a small scale, then it must be true on a greater scale. So if we're stuck in that ray, we see our own self stuck, then the Absolute, it's almost infinite. Almost infinite, the dichotomy. You know, there was the manifestation of creation, and it's dead. It's like, come on. Come on, wake up. Come on, it's pretty cool over here. Come back. And there's no response. And there's no response. And then there's no response. There's no response. It's like you can see the clear goal, and you can see the green pasture of freedom, in a sense. And yet, you never quite get there. So can we hold that in ourselves? So, and then we go on a couple pages later, and it's important to realize that we're not talking about guilt here. Individuals afflicted with this ailment do not believe that anything outside themselves has any reality. The whole world is viewed as something for their convenience. So if you're in that place, then it's a guilt thing. So if you see what's stopping you and you have guilt about it, you're still locked in it. But if you just see it, there it is, that's the thing. It's at work again. It's at work again. And only by seeing the higher purpose and this sense of the suffering in a bigger sense can that begin to become mitigated. Without that moment of, without that tool of mitigation, it will dominate. It will dominate us, and that's what we'll do. And our lives will be one excuse of why we aren't, rather than, yeah, I'm not. And then if we can be in that place of this conscious suffering of our plight, in a sense, we're angelic beings caught on earth, caught and stuck on earth. And as long as we're stuck there, there's this plight where, you know, there's this idea of conscious suffering, okay? And then jumping ahead on 65. But quite aside from this question is the question of obligation, which exists whether we handle it or not. Obligation and responsibility are two different ideas. And you know, we've talked about that just a little bit, the distinction between obligation and duty. We may have responsibility to family, boss, whatsoever. The real obligation can only be to the work. In other words, directly to the absolute, solely for the benefit of the absolute. It's like you're called. You have a calling, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a calling to fulfill. And we see how that forms with a lot of, like, Christian preachers. We see it a lot. You know, like, oh, I've got a calling for Jesus and this sort of thing. And that's okay, however they express it. It's just that it's a different thing. It's a inner calling which we can discover in ourselves. We can discover, like, that, what I call the passion of our being. Like, why are we here? What are we meant to do? We're meant to fulfill this and to bring the ball across the goal line, in a sense, and get as close as we can. And it's defined as called, you know, the perfection of eternal return. Life everlasting by process of eternal conscious return. Okay? So just keep that in mind, the difference between duty, responsibility, and obligation. How to take on the obligation is, once again, these are things that must be practiced. Like, who was it that said, was it Jim H. that talked about this aloneness, standing in aloneness? And what if you stood there for a little bit? You just stood in that. And then you stand there and you look around and you see how desperate things are. Not desperate, but how disparate they are. And you can begin to see how people are suffering, not partly because they grow their stuff, but they're also suffering because they're alone and they're away from the Godhead. They're away from their angelic beingness. And that's what they're missing. That's what they're missing. And that's a tough place to stand. And I brought some stuff.
Did you read this one paragraph here?
Go ahead. Go ahead and read it.
Well, it's on 65. While responsibility depends upon the impulse of duty, which can change its focus of attention from day to day, and even from moment to moment, one's work obligation never alters its centrum of gravity and depends for its actualization entirely upon real conscience towards the absolute. I think that's what you were saying, the day-to-day.
Versus obligation.
Uh-huh.
What we'll do in time, if we really, like, do a self-autobiography, you'll begin to harvest the fact that sense of obligation and that conscience that we have has been steady all your life. It's been a little candle, and then it gets into, like, a teeny little fire, and it grows and grows until it's a burning, it begins to become a blaze. Maybe it isn't quite yet, mm-hmm. but it's been steady Eddie. I remember early on that this was the only work I would ever do. I was like a preteen. I've shared this idea of being in church a number of times where I'm there and I just could sense the feeling of devotion, which true devotion could be. Empty church. And I knew that's what I must do. I didn't know what it meant. I just knew. And so that spark was alive in me then, right?
Well, some part of you didn't know what it meant, but some part of you actually knew exactly what it meant.
Right, and a little teeny bit, and it was there, it was alive, mm-hmm. and I wanted to spark that more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of confidence, that's like, if I'm in that direction, then I know it's correct.
And you were going apart from your mechanical self.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, first of all, I had no language for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Exactly.
I had no language. I didn't know how to think about it. So what we're trying to do today is to develop ways and means. So my question to the class before I get into something else I wanted to read is, do you feel that you can develop ways and means for yourself on this idea of conscious suffering and this idea of pity for the suffering of the absolute? I'm going to put everybody here in the room and on the spot for a minute. There's five of us in total, but I'm going to start with MA. So,
can I keep that in mind?
Can you do? What is your strategy, in a sense? What is the ways and means that you could develop to keep that idea of pity for the suffering of the absolute as a pocket tool, as a, like where your keys are, your cell phone, and that's something that hopefully somebody will, maybe you'll answer for yourself online too.
I'd like to go back to the idea of listening. I think the listening to, not always taking in from the outside, but listening to that still small voice inside
that, yourself.
Yeah, that little piece of the absolute that I allow to come through. It's there, but I'm occluded most of it. And there's a little voice that's still there that if I listen to it, then I can find maybe nanoseconds in my day where I'll actually think about that, and those nanoseconds can build up.
They can build up, no question about it. There's no question it can be built up. So there's a particular, you start with like a listening to that internal cell in yourself, and that's where you start, and then just stop on that place every once in a while during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and compare and contrast that to the rest of the freight train as it goes along, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you want to take a shot at it? Ken? Yeah. So he's saying that for him, what it is that the opportunities occur during the day every once in a while. They click into place in a certain way. And his job, his way to keep it alive is his own conscious suffering. I'm going to put more into when those opportunities occur, can I grab them more? Is that what you say that's a way to put it? Yeah.
We recognize them,
be sensitive to that moment in time that's unique for him. And that way, so right now what we're talking about is building that flame a little bit so that it's a, once the flame is stronger, then we can have a sense of the separateness, that's, then we can have a sense of the pity for the suffering of the Absolute. Okay, go ahead. Do you want to say anything? Put your, come over here. Put your plate down real quick. And
I'm going to have Peter come over here. You want to switch?
Yeah,
I'm going to have him go on mic because what he's saying is very interesting.
Yeah. And, it, and it's got some good depth for it, for his personal work.
Yeah, right over here.
Yeah. So, I recognized that space of joy, of fulfillment to my obligation to the Absolute when I play music. Not all the time, but there are moments when I recognize. And there was a particular moment that I remembered when you were speaking about this space. It was actually a memorial, a service memorial that I did a couple of weeks ago. And I remember telling my father about this space that I was in, and I recognize it as an aspect of my obligation in my work to the Absolute, for the benefit of the Absolute.
Okay, so I'm going to put it in slightly different terms. There's like a sense of working for a higher, to a higher level of skill, or putting more into it. Like there's a standard that you're trying to meet. Particularly, like you were in a memorial, and you were playing for those individuals, right?
For somebody who'd passed. Yeah, it was a service.
So he's playing in this service, and like for instance, he could have done kind of an average job. That's one way you could have done it. Kind of get through it, right? And most people would have just kind of gone like, you know. Or he can obligate himself to the best that he can do. Okay?
And what it feels like, it was both ways. I mean, it was not just, you know, I can do the mechanical part and still do the performance, but it almost felt that it was both ways, that yes, I was doing that, but there was something else that was present as well.
Okay, it's that something else, and that's the fulcrum that I want us to concentrate on. The stuff we're talking about right now is truly esoteric. It's all esoteric means is that it is a hidden work. It's stuff that most of us never talk about. But this moment of that, I call it a transit moment too, between that mechanicality of just getting it done and putting yourself into it. That fulcrum is to stand in that between world is a form of suffering. You're where you can see you're neither here nor there, and you kind of pity for the suffering of yourself, of your own essential self too, because you'll fall back.
And what I'm finding about what you're saying too, that I recognize, remember happening, is that I could look back and then sort of recognize that, oh yeah, or oh, you know, kind of in the moment, I mean, it was just the experience. Whereas after it occurred, then I can, you know, it's like it was afterwards that I was able to, oh wow, what's happening here.
And we'll look back, and those moments are gone then. Like, we had an opportunity, but now it's gone. we had that moment, but we didn't take it, like you were saying, Ken. The opportunity presented, I didn't grab it.
Well, I feel like I did when I was in the moment.
See, this is the point right here, and that's what we need to concentrate on. That's how we can do this work, the ways and means that I'm talking about. So if you carry that edge with you, that's a knife edge. I can do it, and then I didn't. I can't. And it's that dichotomy that where we can place ourselves on that, and when we see ourselves then not make it, when we didn't do it, that's the separation. When we can begin to feel that, our regular everyday sufferings start to mitigate at that time. Okay? Do you want to say anything, Dan, on that point? And is anybody saying anything online that we should read into the mic? Okay. Okay. For anyone else who would like to. Okay, so this idea of conscious suffering, we're going to go for about 5 more minutes or so. We're going to go over time just a bit. And if you have to close the recording, Marvette, so be it.
No, we're fine.
Okay. There's like an obligation offered to us to strive with all our being to serve what is good. All right? There's like an obligation to serve that higher. Well, at the same time, also with all our being, to suffer in full consciousness of the naked fact that it is beyond our strength. Like we can begin to, and then we see, I can't quite get there. And that, then, and only then, can moral power be given to us. Such is the power of morality seen from within, and we may say seen from above. Such is the metaphysics of morality. It is very difficult. But it is just this moment of conscious suffering that can take us again and again across the Socratic threshold by means of a force that touches the whole of man from another level within and above himself. So this idea, conscious suffering must not be confused with what we ordinarily call guilt. It's more of just a factual learning. And I think I told the story a few weeks ago about when I was in Seattle at a celebration of someone that passed, and I was giving talking about the person and what they had meant to me and thankful for them. And I got to a place where I knew I had an opportunity to express a deep emotion. And that deep emotion would have been helpful and important to everybody there. And I got to the point, and it got to a certain level, and I couldn't do it. I blocked it. I froze internally. That was that time. I look back on that, and I thought, and you know, it's like I shake my head about myself. Because I had an opportunity, and yeah, maybe, I don't know what would have happened, how I would have felt if I'd been able to get there. I know it would have been a breakthrough moment. And it would have been a breakthrough moment for everybody there. Several people came up to me after, thanked me anyway, you know, about it, because of there was so much of an expression that I was aware of yet another level of something that could have come up in me. But I, my physicality, my mechanicality, couldn't hold that much energy at that time. Couldn't do it. It was offered to me, and I couldn't quite get there. So we'll see what happens next time when I'm offered that opportunity.
I'm reminded that's when also the practice of service comes in, right? Because in that moment, we have the opportunity to serve perhaps an angelic presence that's coming down to perform what it needs to do, and we can be of service in that moment.
We're going to be getting into the later chapters of several of the later chapters, 14 and 15 for sure, about the angelic realms. And sometimes, if we can make this vessel, cleanse this vessel enough so that this vessel can hold that energy that it can hold, then maybe we can provide a service in a different way than I don't mean like a service to mankind in a sense, but it's that too. But it's like a service of being a vessel. And I have had experiences where I had the opportunity and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that for small amounts of time. That does occur exactly in that way. And the more we can hone our mechanicality, or rather set it aside when it's to be set aside, then something can happen. That's called service. That's why we do it. Not so we get better, but so we can serve that higher. And our longing to serve the higher and our lack of ability to do it is a form of personal suffering that if we can stand there without guilt, that's a precious alchemical fire that we can work with. That, if we can find those ways and means for ourselves, that's something. Okay? So that's about it. And I don't know who's on tonight, but we have a different cast of characters, but if someone, Jim H. or Aria usually sends me the log. I'm not sure if she's on tonight. But I would appreciate it if someone sends the log and then I'll post it on the site. Ways and means. We're trying to interpret this chapter, this work that's been given in this outline, that here's how it works. How are you going to do it in your own life? And we saw a couple of examples here. So the more you can share that, and if you can share it on the site, wingsofchaos.com, that would help everybody. So I don't know if that's, is that it?
What are we doing here?
Go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Where do you want to be? Where are you at? Where are you coming from? Like for me.
Can sit here. Sit here for just, that's a good point, and you're making an important point for a lot of people using the orbs. Mm-hmm. Turn your head the other way.
It is important.
Yeah. Well, in using one of the orbs, one of the questions I put to myself is, going forward, one of the things I said was to make contact with people or be in contact with people, and then beyond that, to be of service. I just kept it short and simple. Even if it is, you don't have any control over what that means, and kind of find yourself in circumstances where you may not particularly, anyway, would have, a lot came from it because I had to write it out, and I saw some things. It was an interesting experience, but it wasn't anything you can plan, and it came from the oracle. Somehow the oracle, when you ask a question or you question yourself, it focuses attention, and something comes from it, but you don't know where it's coming from or what it's going to be. It's like an answer, and it's the opportunity to work with it, and you may not want to. It's a struggle sometimes, but it was in this case. Okay. That's all. Okay, so all of us, we're working together. There's several of us that keep coming to these classes, and all of us are looking to perfect different ways and means for each other. So the more we can share how we particularly do it, it helps others remember then how do they do it and those opportunities. But I think that's it for this evening. And next week, we're going to move on to Chapter 8. And Chapter 8 is How I Changed the Inevitable. So, and I think we're going to find some really interesting, the summary is going to be very interesting for us as well. So that's it for this evening. Thank you for coming. And I appreciate everybody and the work everyone's doing to keep this alive. So good night, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for a good evening, Dave.
Thank you, Silverdale.